our story, Ellen and I met in college. We are now married, but we met our freshman year and found out we had a few things in common, including we're both very interested and concerned about environmental issues. And we both ended up doing research in college on climate change and about the Earth's climate system and in the geosciences department at Princeton University. And we actually had labs right next to each other for our senior thesis. And so I'll show you a little bit about what that was like. Whoops. Sorry, this is a little bit sensitive. This is just a picture of me in a facility where they collect and store what are called ice cores. Some of you might be familiar with this, but essentially, scientists have gone to the polar ice caps to drill down way deep into the ice. They collect samples and then they study this because we can learn a lot about the Earth's history and how climate change has happened over time. So I got a great opportunity to do some work on this, and here we are going into this facility in Denver, Colorado. It's a big giant freezer, and they have all these ice cores stored there so scientists can go and study them. So we got our samples. Here's just what some of the cores look like in these little bags, and then we cut up different pieces, and then we can analyze them in the lab. So that's what I'm doing here. We can talk more about what exactly experiments we run, but I don't want to bore you all to death. So, and then, like I said, Ellen was right next door doing research on a different aspect of climate science. And do you want to talk a little bit about what you did?
Sure. So, like Eddie mentioned, I also studied the past climate system, and I focused on the ocean environment. And one of the reasons why scientists are so interested in looking at ice cores like Eddie did or the past ocean is because the Earth has gone through a series of different warm and cold periods, and by trying to understand how the Earth functioned during those past times, we can actually learn more about what might happen to the Earth and its systems as the climate continues to warm. So I was studying the nitrogen cycle, which is very closely linked to photosynthesis, and trying to establish new protocols to figuring out how much nitrogen and what types of nitrogen were in the past ocean. And we actually developed a new system that I was Googling this morning to see what has happened with it, and the exciting thing is this new protocol that I helped develop is still being used today to try to figure out what the ocean was like hundreds of thousands of years ago.
So what did we learn? From the work that I did on the ice cores, we ended up actually publishing a paper, which is kind of exciting, in a scientific journal, and basically gave us a lot of insights about what happened in Greenland about 250,000 years ago, and when the climate of the Earth had been warmer, what was the history there, and what can we maybe expect from things like sea level rise in the future as we get to conditions that might have been like that. And like Ellen said, they learned a lot more about the ocean and productivity in there, and that's closely linked to the climate system. So this is all, there's a vast sort of body of research and evidence about the Earth's climate and how it's evolved over thousands of years, and that's really what we were looking at, and I think what supports kind of the knowledge today about where we're potentially going in the future as we continue to contribute to global warming through greenhouse gas emissions. So just to give you a little bit more on that, you might have seen some charts like this in the past if you've learned a little bit about climate change, but this is sort of the kind of information that comes from these ice cores So this is a ice core from Antarctica, dating back. Now I think they've gone back close to a million years, and it shows you what the temperature was like, and also the carbon dioxide. And you can see the carbon dioxide in the blue and the temperature in the red are pretty closely matched. So that's what we're looking at. And so, and you can see here. Right here is about, this is about 10,000 years ago. You know, that's when human civilization first kind of started to develop and agriculture and all that such. And you can see we've been in a pretty nice kind of stable period for all that time. And so the concern is now we're kind of shooting way up in this territory with CO2 and potentially with the temperature. And, you know, we're going way beyond what we've seen in sort of our collective history as a species, and that's a big concern. So, this is just the more recent, you know, from what we've observed, actually, from temperature measurements over many decades. And, you know, you can see pretty clearly that the temperature's going up, and that, you know, there hasn't really been any pause in that temperature in the last decade, so as you might hear some people claiming, and it's yeah. Go ahead, in the back of the room.
On that last slide, can you talk anything about what was causing it to happen? I mean, why was there that fluctuation to begin with?
Sure. So there's a lot of things that have affected Earth's climate throughout history, and a big factor being things like orbital cycles. You know, there's the Earth is actually at various points closer or farther to the Sun, and these are cycles that happen over hundreds of thousands of years. So there's been times in the past when we were a little bit farther, maybe we're in an ice age at that point, and then it's a little bit closer. So, but the key thing to remember is that what we've seen in the last 150 years has been a rate of change that's really unprecedented. I mean, those cycles play out over hundreds of and thousands of years, and we've seen changes in just a couple of decades that are much faster than what's happened in there. So.
And those cycles that Eddie mentioned that deal with the orbital geometry of the Earth, including the precession, they're called Milankovitch cycles.
Mm. Yep. So, you know, this is just a list of some of the impacts that I think, you know, a lot of people are concerned about. This is a list I actually copied from one of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, which are kind of the gold standard in terms of our state of knowledge about climate change and its impacts. And they've released a bunch of these reports over many years, and they have ones that focus on the science, they have ones that focus on the impacts, and then also ones that focus on what we can do to mitigate those impacts and adapt to them. So this is just, you know, a kind of a short list of some of the potential problems. You know, we talk about sea level rise, there's ocean acidification, more wildfires, very important issue here in California, more powerful hurricanes, heat waves, a lot of ecological impacts. You know, that speed of change we talked about is, you know, maybe there are species that can't really adapt to those shifts. If they're located in one region, it takes a long time to shift habitats. And of course, you know, health impacts to our food supplies, a lot of dislocation of certain populations, and, you know, there's evidence that that's even what's happening in places like the Middle East and in Syria. Some of the unrest that we're seeing is in some ways linked to the fact that it's very hard to have productive farming there in recent years, and people are moving around, and this dislocation is leading to a lot of problems. And so, you know, a lot of issues, and of course, one of the things I think that probably folks here would be concerned about from an equity and justice standpoint is a lot of these impacts are really going to be centered on the poor and vulnerable populations in our world. So, you know, we have a lot, I think, of responsibility to try to address those issues and help the people that are going to be most suffering from that. I think that's one. This is just a recent study was done on also the economic impacts here in the U.S. and just showing this was, you know, a very comprehensive study done showing where, you know, the most economic impact would be in different parts of the U.S. So a lot in the South very heavily impacted as these temperatures climb. That's going to be a big factor there. So we've learned a lot about what the impacts are, and you know, obviously it's a big concern. Now we want to pivot to, well, what do we do? And sort of, I think Ellen and I, at some point when we were doing this research and learning about these problems, decided, well, you know, we could continue to work in the lab and learn about things, but you know, we really kind of felt like we wanted to do something about it, and how do we make a change? And so in starting to think about that, you know, it's good to, I think, to get a sense of, well, what's causing it? And you can see this is just a little diagram to show you where all these greenhouse emissions are coming from, and you can see there's some big slices of the pie. The one here is electricity, so that's a big slice of the pie. And you've also got industry, transportation. These are other big slices. So some, you know, key areas to focus on if we want to try to stem the tide on some of these impacts. And so Ellen and I eventually got very interested in the electricity sector and a couple of key things we could do there, and that's kind of where we've ended up in our career. So, yeah. I think that's agriculture, forestry, and land use. And so there's certain things like, yeah, deforestation or different agricultural land use changes that are a big impact too. And there's a lot of people working on better practices there. But yeah.
Are there divisions of places?
Oh, this. No, and I should have put that in there. This was another IPCC chart just to show kind of where emissions are coming from. Sorry.
Did you get to work with
We took his class. Yeah.
Paul is asking about a professor from Princeton University who's done a lot of thought leadership about how the United States and the globe could respond to climate change. And he's put forward a lot of different concepts and different pathways forward. And we had the opportunity to take one of his classes, which was great.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the big learnings from that is, you know, for a while, people were always talking about, well, what's this kind of silver bullet solution we can look for, and what they kind of helped to realize was that there's not one thing we can do. It's going to have to be a whole suite of different solutions that people are going to have to work on, and they call these the different wedges. So you can stack up these wedges, and then you get to a bigger pie that adds up to the whole. And so, you know, they identified, I think it was like, you know, 14 wedges, and you know, you needed 7, I think, to help stabilize the climate. And now people, I think, have a better understanding of this kind of varied approach and how we need efforts in all these different areas. True. Yeah, exactly. Time is definitely of the essence in this problem, so that's another big factor here, and one that's, I think, difficult for people to understand because it's you know, it's different than I think a lot of other public policy issues where, you know, maybe there's an issue that you want to deal with at some point, but really we have the clock is ticking, and we want to try to address this as quickly as possible.
I believe you had a question as well.
Mm-hmm. I finally understood it. One of the issues is we're recording the talk, and I'd like to be able to record the comments that you're hoping to have.
Oh, sure.
Can you all share the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Do you want to talk about this one?
So, as Eddie mentioned, at one point we were both working in the lab, and we really enjoyed that research, but began being confronted with all of these challenges with the energy system. And this is just a little picture to show some of those issues with the energy system, climate change being one of them. But our utility bills keep rising. We spend a lot of money that we ship out of the state, sometimes out of this country, to generate electricity. And then a lot of the ways that we currently run our electricity system, in addition to climate change, dirty our air and cause other health issues. And so he and I sort of both reflected on this and decided that we wanted to pivot from doing some of the lab research to actually working on policies and other actions that could make a difference. And for me, what was really helpful is I have this mentor named Dave, and he always likes to point to Christopher Robin. And I guess there's some part of Winnie the Pooh where Christopher Robin talks about his socks moving up and down, and it's because he's so happy with what he's doing. And my mentor Dave always said to me, you know, whatever you do in life, you should be so passionate about your work that your socks are moving up and down. And as I was applying for PhD programs and thinking about the research that I did, I liked it, but it was something about it was missing for me. And so I decided that I really needed to make a change, that it was great to continue to contribute to this body of research, but we know that climate change is happening. What can we actually do about it to respond? So this, as I was applying to PhD programs, thinking about this quote and what my mentor Dave said to me really is what kind of pushed me over the edge and decide to change my career path. And I think similar for Eddie. And we basically asked ourselves, this issue is so important. What is it that we can do? And I know for me personally, I went around and I started having a lot of conversations with different people. You know, I spent time looking at some of those graphs that Eddie showed and tried to figure out where can I as an individual try to have the biggest impact to change the discussion and change the outcomes of this climate crisis that we're facing.
So just a quick kind of snapshot of some of the things that we've been working on. Like I said, we've focused on the power sector and looking a lot at solutions like energy efficiency, which is really Ellen's specialty, and she'll talk a lot more about that. Looking at how we can design our system to provide maximum benefit to electricity customers. This is a very complex kind of technical and political issue, and there's a lot of ways that we think we could do better for all people that are participating in the system. Renewable energy, that's been sort of my focus mainly, and also energy storage as a helpful tool for integrating renewable energy onto our power grid. And so a few examples, and there's more that we can talk about, but just energy efficiency in Arizona. While we're there, Ellen worked a lot on that, and I helped out a bit. And then we also did, you know, more recently I've been doing some work on renewable energy in New England as well with a few of our client projects in my company. And then also we both worked on a lot on electricity rates, which affect millions of customers and really set the stage for whether or not we're encouraging people to do more clean energy and help them have a fair and equitable system that, you know, people aren't paying too much on their bills. And, you know, like Alan said, when we're thinking about where can we have the biggest impact on some of these problems, what we quickly realize is that policy matters a lot. And this is just a great kind of example I like to talk about is this map's showing you how much solar energy potential there is in different parts of the world. So we've got the U.S. there, and you can see the big orange spot in the southwest. We've got great solar here in California and parts of the southwest. Not so great in Alaska, but here's Germany over there. Germany's not got great sun either, but you can see that they actually have more solar installed than we do. So that doesn't make any sense, right? But the reason is that Germany's been sort of the world leader in advancing their policies to support clean energy, and they've decided to make it a priority for them through different incentive programs and other things that have really spurred the industry there, and they've led the way. So despite the fact that they don't have the best solar potential, they've found a way to make it work there. And same thing even within the U.S. You have states like New Jersey and Massachusetts that are now beating out states like Arizona, which has really good potential. And that's all about the policies that these jurisdictions have put into place to support that. So, you know, it's not, in my view, almost, it's not a technical problem. It's a political problem, and you know, we have to figure out good ways to address it that way.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about energy efficiency because, as Eddie mentioned, that's my area of specialty. And I always get people asking me questions about why did I leave research where I got to travel all around the world and go on these amazing boat trips to crawling around in attics and trying to advocate for policies that lead to more LED light bulbs. And it's a good question because in some ways it's not quite as fun or as adventurous as my old life, but I'm really passionate about this issue because as I mentioned before, as I was researching different ways to have an impact, it became so clear to me that one of the best things that we can all do is to save energy. How do you? And I think when a lot of people think about energy efficiency or saving energy, they often think about these pictures that I have here on the slide. So turning off the lights when you leave the room, adjusting your thermostat, you know, maybe replacing the light bulbs in your home and installing compact fluorescent light bulbs, CFLs, or LEDs. And energy efficiency is definitely all of those things, but it's actually so much more than that. And one of the things that I work on is to get these big programs and policies in place to have much more energy efficiency done at the state level. And in addition to some of those behavioral changes I talked about and making light bulbs more accessible, there are all sorts of different programs that are out there to promote energy efficiency. There's a lot that's done, for example, with building energy codes and new construction to make sure that the homes that we build the first time aren't leaky and really wasteful. Because if they are, then we have to spend a bunch of money and go back and fix them after the fact. One of the states that I do a lot of work in is Arizona, and you all probably have seen the news about how over the last couple of weeks airplanes couldn't take off and it's been 120 plus degrees there. Air conditioning, people need it to survive, and yet in homes and buildings, these air conditioning systems have been installed, so they're not attached to ductwork. They're basically blowing cold air into the attic, and money is flowing out the window. So there's a lot of focus in that state in particular to making sure that we have efficient air conditioners in place and that when we put them in that they're installed correctly. And there's a lot of work that's done on education and information for consumers as well. And what's interesting about these energy efficiency programs is I'd be willing to bet you that you all have participated in them and you have no idea. And that's part of the design, because we are trying to make energy efficient decisions as seamless as possible. And so sometimes when you take the consumer decision making out of it, it makes it easier for customers to make the more efficient decision. And one way that that's done is working with stores like Home Depot to make sure that when they have those end cap displays, that the most efficient products are the ones that are the most visible. Or actually, when you buy a more efficient refrigerator, often the cost of those appliances are bought down, so it's less expensive for you to pay for them. So there are a bunch of things that are happening, whether it's building energy codes. And again, I would guarantee that you all have participated in these programs and had no idea that that's the case. And that's really the way that we try to design them. And
I mentioned one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about energy efficiency, in addition to climate reasons, is because it actually just makes a lot of economic sense. And it's a policy and an investment that you can really get everyone across the political spectrum on board. For the most part. I'm happy to talk about that more if you have questions. And part of that reason is because it's actually the cheapest option that we have available. And this is a graph, not that I put together, but that the largest electric utility in Arizona put together. And it shows the costs of different energy resources. And in the far left, in the light blue, that's the cost of their existing system. And right next to it is a bar for energy efficiency. And you can see that energy efficiency costs less than generating electricity from their current sources. So every time we put a dollar into energy efficiency, the people in Arizona are actually saving money, because otherwise the dollar would be going to something else that's comparatively more expensive. Can you go to the next one? The other big thing that makes me so excited about working on this policy is that not only is it saving people money right now, but it's saving them money in the future. And that's because in states that are growing, as electricity demand increases, we eventually have to build new infrastructure to meet that demand. And that can be done in a number of ways, but often we build new power plants, and those are really expensive. We all pay for that on our utility bills, and because of the way that regulation works, you basically pay for that power plant plus interest on it. And this ends up being, you know, billions of dollars that's distributed amongst all of that. And so if we can keep electricity demand from increasing, then we don't have to build this new infrastructure that costs us all a lot of money.
Just to add to that, so if you build a new power plant, it can be there for 40, 50, 60 years. It's really important that we get this right? Because if we get, if we have to build a bunch of new power plants today, they're going to be around for a long time, and it's very hard to, it makes our challenge harder, because if we build more fossil fuel power plants, they're going to stay there for a long time, and it's going to be more difficult to reach those climate goals. So, you know, that's why we're looking long term, and how can we avoid having to put some of those in place.
When you say we, then I'm thinking about the people that are going to build the power plants are the big utility companies. And if I were a big utility company, I would be looking for the cheapest way to build a generating system. Doesn't work that way? I mean, I'd love your comments. Thank you.
It's a great question.
That's a really good question, because you would think that makes sense.
Well, on the other side of it, though, they get to charge you on the basis of what they paid, so it's not in their benefit particularly.
It's a bit perverse in the utility business, because they actually make more money by building more stuff, and that's kind of how the traditional models worked. Unlike most industries, where cutting costs is the priority, it's actually the other way around for a lot of these utilities. So that makes it a real challenge when you're trying to get them on board with some of these issues. But you know, there are ways to do it, or at least help, and that's a lot of what we work on.
And just to build on what Eddie mentioned, a big part of energy efficiency is always also trying to buy more time. So renewable energy investment is really critical for us to solve the climate challenges that we're facing. But one of the challenges that we have now is that a lot, when a utility is making decisions about an investment, oftentimes right now they really want to invest in natural gas. And they'll bring up questions and concerns about the variable nature about renewable energy. You know, the sun is not always shining, the wind is not always blowing. And so what we're trying to do with energy efficiency policies is push off infrastructure investment decisions so we can allow more time for technology to evolve evolve so that when we have to make some of these hard decisions, we're making the right ones that are best for customers and also best for climate. So really what we're trying to do is build a bridge and extend that bridge so we can provide time, for example, for cost of battery storage to decrease so it's more cost effective and less expensive for customers to pay for. And we touched on these, but a lot of the policies that we're working on, including energy efficiency, have a bunch of benefits across the board. And that's what we're really trying to do, is focus on these policies that are a win-win for customers and for climate. And just to give you an example, and we can talk more about the individual policy work that Eddie and I both do at the state level, but one of the big policies that I work on is called an energy efficiency resource standard. And you may have heard of a renewable portfolio standard before. California has been a big champion of them. And basically, it's a policy that requires a utility company to procure a certain amount of renewable energy on behalf of its customers. Well, on the energy saving side, we actually have a similar policy, which requires utility companies to work with their customers to get a certain amount of energy savings. And these policies are in place in about half the states, including some of the most conservative states in the country. Believe it or not, Arizona has the second strongest policy in the country, which a lot of people are surprised by. But what you can see from this graph is they make a huge difference. This is a graph that shows Michigan before and after it put its policies in place and how much energy efficiency it was doing. Before, it was doing nothing, and afterwards, the amount that it was doing grew, you know, very, very significantly. And so these policies that we work on, they have a huge impact. And just to give you a sense, I mentioned the policy that I helped to put in place in Arizona. If that policy weren't in place, this is a timeline, and I apologize, it's a little bit small, but it shows 2014 through 2029. If we weren't doing that policy, that's the number of power plants we would be building in place. So it's a lot, and that's just for one utility. So imagine doing some of these policies with many different utilities across the country. And that's basically what we do. This is just a map I pulled out showing you where, at least from an energy efficiency perspective, where the stars show that where we've had policy wins this year, the minuses are where we have threats that we're fighting. The pluses are places where they're looking at doing new things, and the pluses and minuses are kind of a mixed bag. And so Eddie and I kind of fly all around the country to these different states advocating for these different policies. So that's why we're gone a lot. But, you know, it's I get asked a lot with the new president, how are these energy policy and climate discussions being impacted? And they certainly are. But one thing I think that gives me a lot of hope is that a lot of innovation and incubation of ideas has traditionally come from the state level. I mean, California is a huge champion, and we really haven't had a federal energy policy in place in this country. And so even though we're seeing a lot of opposition at the federal level and from the presidency, there's still a lot of work that's happening at the state level that's driving change and is allowing the U.S. to address some of these climate issues that we're facing. You know, you can see some of these states that have a star, like Maryland and Nevada, those are actually states with Republican governors. And in Colorado, the policy that got adopted this year, it was actually a bipartisan bill, Republicans and Democrats working together. And I don't want to say that it's always that easy, because these are really this work in states is really tough, but it's had a huge, huge impact.
Can I ask? Could you give us a few examples of what you mean by a positive policy and a negative policy?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you first an example of a positive policy. I mentioned that one of the policies I work on is this energy efficiency resource standard, which requires utilities to save energy with their customers. So Colorado has had one of those policies in place for a number of years, and they just extended their policy for 10 more years. So they're planning for the next decade to continue down this path. On the flip side, Ohio used to really be a leader for both renewable energy and energy efficiency, and was one of the earlier Midwest states to adopt both a renewable portfolio standard and an energy efficiency standard. And in 2014, it got rid of those policies. And there's been a huge debate over the last 3 years about what to do, and it's very politicized. At the end of last year, there was kind of a consideration about taking those policies off the books completely. And this may be surprising to some, but Governor Kasich actually vetoed that bill because he understands that renewable energy and energy efficiency investment is important for Ohio and important for manufacturers in the state. But now there are some people in the state that are trying to override his veto and keep those policies off the book. And it's that state in particular has been a complete roller coaster where they've had a policy in place, they've taken it away, they've put it back, they've taken it away. And it's made it really challenging for people to decide whether or not to invest in Ohio, to be honest, because it's so confusing. And so that's an example. I mentioned I work for a number of Fortune 50 and 100 companies. One of the companies I work for is Whirlpool Corporation. They have 10,000 employees in the state of Ohio, and they really care about these policies because they have invested in Ohio. They do 2/3 of all of their North American manufacturing in Ohio. They want a more diverse energy mix, and they're looking out a number of years, and so they've been pushing back and saying and telling lawmakers there, we really need these policies. This is actually the right economic and business decision to make. And I think we're seeing more and more of these businesses come forward saying, you know, this is not a political issue. This is not a Republican versus Democrat issue. This is just a smart thing that we should be doing. So hopefully that answered your question.
Okay, and we'd be more than happy to talk more, and I could talk a lot more about the renewable energy side of things to give you a little bit of a taste of that, but I think that, you know, that's been pretty well covered. You know, energy efficiency doesn't always get the spotlight, so I'm glad Ellen got a chance to kind of present that. And but now I think we just wanted to sort of tee up a bit of a discussion with the group here. We're new, and we want to get a better sense of what's going on. And we've seen some really interesting things that the church has been engaged on environmental issues generally and environmental justice issues. And we want to just talk a little bit about what are we doing, what can we do, I think the way I sort of break that down is that you can have, there's a lot we can do directly. There's a lot we can do in terms of educating ourselves and doing outreach to everyone here and the rest of the congregation. And then finally, there's what are we doing big picture wise? And obviously, some of this work is these policies matter, and there's things I think that can be done to help as a collective group. So just wanted to sort of put that out there and see if people have questions generally about the presentation, or we can get into more of this kind of discussion as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, my approach to this is what I call retro-tech. And that is adopting technologies that have previously existed in past times. As an example, if you're going somewhere, instead of driving, you go on a bicycle, or you go on a skateboard, or you walk. And if you're staying home, you can live outdoors in the shade if you set up in your front yard a table and some chairs. And you can even spread the word, because when people go by and see how comfortable you are there, spending no energy at all except what the sun provides from the sky, they're influenced in following your example. And if it's getting products, you can bypass the industry by putting things that you don't want out on the curb with a little sign that says free. And then when you're walking, as I hope you will be doing, you will come across lots and lots of free products, and to don't have to be remanufactured, including a lot of garments, because people are reducing and then they're getting the weight back again. And whenever they do that, they put a lot of garments out next to the curb with a little sign that says free. And a lot of those things fit you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for all your work and sharing it with the communities. I wanted to ask about this recent, I'm sure you know, the controversy between Stanford Group and this other group, which was, anyway, A and B. And it seems as though this could threaten some of the rationale for pursuing very vigorous energy policies that have been in place. And I just, you know, would appreciate your feedback, your position on this.
Yeah, great question. I'll give you some background. A few years back, there was a Stanford professor that did a study on our energy system and looking at the question, could we get to 100% renewable energy? And he found that yes, it was doable. And this was sort of a sea change in some people's thinking around this, because before it was kind of like, well, maybe we can get to 15% or 20% might be hard, but now it's suddenly out there that we could get to 100% renewable energy, and that was set the bar higher. So it inspired a lot of people. We had a lot of grassroots efforts now to you know, communities that want to achieve 100%. Another group of scientists that looked at this and said, well, you know, this looks pretty good, but there's some assumptions in the modeling that maybe it's a little questionable. So, you know, we ought to relook at this and you know, try to get a more accurate picture. And my understanding is that the Stanford group didn't take too kindly to that and kind of stuck to their guns, and so it became somewhat controversial in terms of, you know, how far could we get. The other group was saying, well, we can get probably to, you know, 80 or 90% pretty easily, but that last bit is going to be really tough to do. So, you know, that's what our modeling shows. And then, so there's a lot of back and forth. I think there were some lawsuits filed. I actually got a chance to do some work with one of the authors of the critique, and so I think it's a little unfortunate, you know, that it kind of evolved this way, because again, in my view, that sort of we're not there yet. It's you know, the 100% is a really great sort of ambitious thing to achieve, but I don't think we really need to be debating that right now, because if we can get to 80%, that's great. And then by then, we'll have learned so much about what we need to do next that I think it's going to be you know, easier to put our heads around. But right now, I mean, literally, California is the leading place in the world, and they're at 50%. So it's, again, I think it detracts a little bit from, you know, forward momentum when we have these debates about what's, you know, way in the future, and we need to just focus on what we can do now and really push the bar up. So.
To put that in perspective, I mean, there are a number of states that are, you know, basically at 0% or don't have these policies in place. And so I think it was really helpful to have, it's really helpful to have that thought leadership out there, because it gives, it kind of gives a bookend that we can aspire to. But sometimes these debates, it becomes a little bit unfortunate because people get so wrapped up in the debates that we forget that we need to be working right now to achieve whatever we can achieve, because this is such a challenging issue that we're facing as a planet. Did that answer your question?
So in California, well, in the Northwest in California, there's a lot of effort to remove dams on rivers and lakes. And that's going to cut into a renewable source of energy in the hydro. How does that fit into your picture here? I mean, do you advocate more dams, less dams, or, you know?
Yeah, it's... You know, hydro is a really important part of the power mix, in especially in the Pacific Northwest. They get most of their power from hydroelectric, and it's a very complex issue, because you have it intersects with the ecosystem there, especially with fish. You know, that's a big ecological factor, that they have certain restrictions in place and concerns about the industry, the salmon and other fish up there. So it's amazing to me, actually, just how many things tie in with the energy system, water, wildlife, everything's tied in. But, you know, the thing about hydro is that there's not too much about building new hydro at this point, at least in this country. And there's large hydro, yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's some opportunities for smaller, you know, run-of-the-river type systems, but for those large hydro dams that went in, you know, a century ago or, you know, decades ago, there's not really too much more that can be put into place now. And so as far as the removal goes, I'm sure that will have an impact. Some of that might be offset by the fact that we are getting higher and higher penetrations of renewable energy, but you know, the hydro is an important resource for certain things too. It has some capabilities that others don't. So I'd be interested to, you know, look more into that problem. I'm not an expert on these proposals to remove dams and what that could mean, but I'm sure that there's many different perspectives and stakeholders involved in those, and I don't know what the right answer is. So.
I would add that in addition to some of these conversations that are happening around hydro, there's also several conversations happening in the country about the future of the nuclear fleet. So you may have heard, for example, that in Illinois last year, there was a big decision to bail out two of the nuclear plants there that were no longer economic, and you know, had those plants closed, it was going to be pretty impactful to the two communities, because there were a lot of people in those communities hired. But that's not a unique conversation just to Illinois. These conversations and policy debates about nuclear have come up in New York. There is going to be a similar one in the next few months in Pennsylvania. And I think they're really challenging questions that, you know, have climate impacts, economic impacts, impacts to real communities, and there aren't really easy answers. What I think was interesting, what Illinois decided to do, is that when they put together this legislative package to bail out the nuclear plants there, they also coupled it with more aggressive renewable energy and energy efficiency policies. So basically, Illinois decided that in addition to keeping these nuclear plants running, it was going to double down on solar and double down on energy savings. And so as a result, it brought together some really unique and different stakeholders that aren't always on the same side of the issue, and they pushed together for this legislative solution. And it will be interesting to see what happens in some of these other states where this real question is coming up.
Just to add to that, Ellen mentioned the communities, these plants. I think one of the biggest challenges of this transition that we're in now is, what do we do about the communities that might be left behind? And especially, you know, we've seen this with the closure of coal-fired power plants and coal mines. And obviously we want to move towards cleaner, more renewable energy system. But, you know, there's a lot of people in those communities that have livelihoods that depend on that. And how are we going to be able to help those communities transition, help the workers there, you know, retrain and into other industries? And that's something that is people are thinking about to some degree, but I think there could be so much more done to facilitate that.
Mm-hmm. Alan, Eddie, thank you so much. On two parts, for our children that are coming up and hopefully that you will be having or adopting. We need materials that really talk about it's their future, you know. It's their future. And we need something that is understandable for them to have in their materials that we can give as part of the, you know, our principles, you know, the... Okay. The other part is at the UUA level, where that organization that we pay into to that talks to all of our UU churches, for this some of this information to be in a curriculum-based way that we can disseminate to all the churches. What you just said last is the reason why, you know, the Agent Orange is in the White House right now, you know, is that people begging for jobs. I mean, very simple in the Maslow, you know, hierarchy. They need jobs, and jobs being lost and not understanding some of the principles involved. So these churches, our churches, are going to be talking to folks who are in crises, have lost jobs, or the stress that happens. So like you were saying, it affects everywhere. And having you as you use and, you know, young people looking at the future, if you would think about some ways that we could concisely put some materials and submit it to the UUA so that maybe UUCB is at the forefront of presenting some of this information.
And just a quick comment on that, and maybe Paul wants to jump in about the Green Sanctuary work that he's... I don't know, Paul, do you want to mention anything about the Green Sanctuary and the Green...
Well, yeah, I was going to suggest that be done as part of our Green Sanctuary.
That could be part of our green sanctuary certification. You know, as part of what we submit, we've got to submit a packet to the Green Sanctuary UUA committee, and certainly we can demonstrate. May everybody just remember that we've got you know, solar panels on our roof, that since 2008 we've avoided about 1 million pounds of CO2 emissions because of our commitment of all of you who made that financially possible. And that's something we need to be shouting from the rooftops and telling our kids that, you know, we've made that commitment. I just briefly had, as also someone who works in this space, I struggle with my pessimism. I'm working hard to make the financial, technical case to avoid the construction of about a gigawatt of coal power in Kenya. One of the outcomes of China making the global commitments is they have a tremendous overcapacity in fossil power construction, and they're marching across the globe and providing financing to plants that often don't make sense to a country that has tremendous renewable potential and hydro potential, and both across all of East Africa. But with regard to my pessimism, you know, it feels to me that looking at Bob Sokol's wedges and thinking about the challenges, that in a way we've committed our fate over about the next 100 to 200 years. And everything that we're doing, not to say what we're doing now is going to affect the future of our children's 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 children. About 7 generations out, it's going to make a huge impact. What we're doing now is going to impact what the world is like in 200 or 300 years. But with regard to the next 1 to 200, we've kind of cast that die. And I wonder if you have thoughts about that.
So we may both have thoughts on that. I try not to get too wrapped up in feeling pessimistic because we have so much work that needs to be done. And, you know, some of this work that we do at the state level is horribly frustrating. It's so politicized. It's not really based on facts. And sometimes that just, it makes me so angry. But I just try to focus, honestly, how can I spend most effectively my time every day to continuing to advance the policy conversation? Because you're right, we may have already committed ourselves to a certain fate, but the way I think back on it is when I'm older and I look back, I want to know that I tried everything that I could in my career to try to make a difference on this issue. And so that's what I try to focus on. And when I lose a policy or something, I just try to pivot quickly. All right, what can I do next? Because otherwise, it can become horribly depressing. And I like to think about some of the wins that we have been able to secure, some of them that are really surprising. I mentioned Arizona, for example. People are shocked when they hear that Arizona has the second strongest policy in the country. Eddie and maybe Eddie's mom are maybe the only ones in this whole room that knew that, because typically when people think of Arizona, they think of it as having pretty regressive policies. But it is really possible in some of these states, with the right messengers, with the right information, to have an impact, and I think that's hugely exciting.
To that, I mean, one of my professors in grad school had a good quote, was just like, well, yes, we are baked in to some degree, and you know, the next several decades to what we've done in the past. So, but you know, 2 degrees warming is better than 3 degrees warming. 3 degrees warming is better than 4 degrees, and 4 degrees is better than 9 degrees. So, you know, I think to the extent that we can continue, at least on a directional level, to achieve those goals, that's a good thing. You know, I don't know. It's so hard to know what the future holds, right? Technology is always advancing at paces that we don't necessarily have foresight into, and so I still also remain optimistic. And, you know, I think even if we don't sort of get everything we would like, you know, even if we don't kind of get the level of mobilization that I think probably is needed for some of the worst impacts, I think we're still helping people in the meantime. Ellen talked about there's a lot of benefit that pursuing these goals achieves beyond the climate issue, just from, you know, equity standpoint and justice and you know, local air quality problems, many things. So I don't think, you know, even if your perspective is the long term, I think let's also remember that there's a lot of short-term benefits that can come from this, too.
One other thing I'd add, and this is applicable to other policies that are being debated at the federal level right now, is that, you know, we're not always going to win, but I like thinking that when people speak up in opposition, that when history looks back, there's a public record to say people didn't just let this go and pass and come to be. I don't know, something for me about that is just really powerful, that we're just not stepping aside, and that we're, you know, we may not always win, but at least there were some voices that spoke up in opposition and made it a little bit harder, a little bit longer for some of these bad things to take place.
I find it amazing to think with pride that California is approaching 50% renewable, but other states are at 0%. And I think we all know that climate change isn't going to have boundaries in 50 years' time. They're not going to reward the kids who live in California versus Ohio. So it begs the bigger question that's incumbent on Californians, not to just sit home and pat ourselves on the back, but maybe reach out to the churches across the country, or maybe create progress that allows the entire U.S., which we know is a big consumer. So what's your sense of, does it require federal legislation? Are there states, is California reaching out and helping other states? Like, what is there any good vision or plan in store where you think it doesn't have to be state by state, but that it can be a bigger difference faster? Because it's really not healthy for all of us to sit home and feel a sense of pride if the world is still melting. Sorry about the gloom and doom.
So we both may have comments on this, so just a couple of reactions. I think one of the biggest differences between now and before the election was that the Obama administration was putting in place a federal framework to have states basically all work together to address climate, and that essentially is now stalled. And I do think that that's unfortunate because it was igniting, even though that framework that they had put out there honestly wasn't that ambitious, it was changing conversations at the state level. People that weren't necessarily thinking about renewable energy in the past were suddenly talking about it. So that is one thing that's a big difference. But as I mentioned before, the history of this country when it comes to energy has really been that this has bubbled up at the state level. And so in a lot of ways, things haven't totally changed. So I think that gives me a lot of hope. I do think it's important for California to continue to be a leader and put a beacon out there and say this is possible. But I do a lot of work in very conservative states, and one of the challenges we have is a lot of those states are very suspicious or skeptical of California. And so we need to continue to model conservative states that can do this too. Because Arkansas, for example, was willing to move forward with policies because they saw Arizona was doing it, not because of California. And that's unfortunately, a lot of politics bleeds into that, and it's just something that we have to be aware of. So we need to continue to lift California up to demonstrate the leading edge, but we have to continue to pick up the bottom at the same time.
I would say also that, I mean, you know, California is reaching out, and they're doing it globally. I mean, they're, you know, Governor Brown is actually meeting with, you know, the president of China to figure these issues out. I mean, they're not stopping because of the Trump administration. They're really seeing this from that global perspective. So I'm encouraged by that. You know, I think that they are doing what they can to develop these partnerships, not just with in the U.S. but outside of it. And Alan mentioned, you know, I think it is important that they be a leader. And, you know, I think it's going to be, and there's some challenges I think they have in doing that because they've made these aggressive targets. And now I think implementing them in a way that doesn't scare people off and, you know, shows that, wow, we can actually do this and it's not going to break the bank. That's a big challenge, but I think is necessary to get others to come on board too.
So I just want to add a comment to that. Haven't I heard that Governor Brown is calling a conference in San Francisco in the very near future, particularly on this subject?
That may be. I haven't been following as much the international.
Okay, well, that's what I've heard.
And I will add also that, you know, in the aftermath of the decision by the U.S. to leave the Paris Agreement, I mean, we did see a lot of states really step up and say, well, we're still moving ahead. And I think that's pretty amazing because even if the U.S. is not in the Paris Agreement, you know, collectively between these cities and these states and these businesses that are doubling down and recommitting to Paris, we're, you know, hopefully effectively getting there anyway, despite what the federal government is deciding to do.
Yeah. I think another problem is the dire predictions that don't materialize. Like, for instance, we live by the ocean here, and it's obvious, at least nobody's complaining that somehow the sea levels are rising and people are losing beachfront property and that kind of stuff. And when when those things don't materialize, let's say they predicted 20, 25 years ago, that's a bit of a challenge, too, to convince somebody that we have to go through all of these policy changes and worldwide redistribution of wealth. You know, I think the message needs a little bit of fine-tuning.
And I'll let Eddie respond to that, too, and I definitely agree with you, and I think that's more and more why we're trying to show that a lot of these policies you should be doing regardless of climate change. You know, talking about energy efficiency, this is helping us to address climate, but it's helping us to address so many other issues as well because it is our cheapest option, and so we're saving money every time we put a buck there instead, and there are health benefits. And, you know, same thing with renewable energy. It's so cost competitive now that, you know, climate is an important reason, but frankly, in my work, especially in conservative states, I never mention climate. That it almost never comes up, actually. So sometimes it's kind of funny talking about it because it's not at the forefront in some of these states. But that's okay because we can still make progress for other reasons and have the climate impact that we need.
Yeah, I think it's partly about knowing who's your audience and what motivates them, because some people are concerned about sea level rise. You know, in places like in Miami, Florida, I mean, they are seeing sea level rise there that's impacting them today, and you know, not everybody there, but some are starting to worry about that, and so maybe that message is more effective for those people, but you know, in places like Midwest and Ohio, it might not be necessary. You just have to find out what motivates people, and you know, both different reasons for doing these solutions, like Ellen said, can still help with the climate problem, even if that's not sort of what is motivating people in the first place.
Maybe even I will understand it someday. Thank you so much, and welcome to UUCB. We hope to hear from you many times more.